It's time for the Fantasy Points Podcast, brought to you by FantasyPoints.com. Top-level fantasy football and NFL betting analysis from every perspective and angle, from numbers to the film room, with a single goal, to help you score more fantasy points.
Welcome in to another episode of the TikTok Podcast. This is a playoff episode of the TikTok Podcast. I am your host, Brett Whitefield, with my usual co-host Stephen O'Rourke and our lovely guest of the day, Christopher Wecht. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. It was a great week of playoffs. Another exciting week ahead of us, I think. Some pretty good matchups coming.
Yeah, Steve, I see you sipping coffee over there with your pinky in the air.
Yeah, feeling real good after last week's slate of games. Felt pretty confident. Vikings. Yeah. Vikings were my only blemish on the week, and I said to you before the podcast, Brett, that like after we got done recording, I retrospectively, and I'm pulling the LeBron James here, but I was like, I don't know if the Vikings pull this off.
Oh my gosh!
But the Jaguars, well, hold on. The Jaguars was the most satisfying of them all, I think. No, actually, I take it back. It was the Cowboys. The Cowboys, as much as I hate to say it, was the most satisfying because I couldn't handle the potential for a Tom Brady Tampa Bay run. It just did not feel like it was supposed to happen or that it was right. That's what it comes down to. It didn't feel right.
Yeah. And I mean, just like Giselle, everyone's ready to move on from Tom, you know? So it's like, come on. Let's just...
Yeah, I mean, she was really the one that started the wheels in motion, and everybody fell in line with that one.
Yeah, so for if you guys don't remember, Steve and I went pick for pick, and Steve got me on two of the games. I picked Tampa Bay, he picked Dallas, and then I also picked the Chargers. And he picked the Jaguars. So Steve, you know, it took 1 week of him getting his picks over on me, and he's already drinking his coffee with a finger in the air, a little pinky, like he's the Prince of England. And Steve, that's not all you did this week. I got to bring it up. You are tied for first place in the Fantasy Points playoff bracket.
Yeah, man. That one.
So like Chris and I are... I think I'm 10 spots down. Chris is like...
I played Brett Maher, a kicker, so...
Well, that'll be
Chris played Brett Maher, a kicker. I think there's like 50 people in it, though, and Steve's tied for first through 1 week. Now, obviously, there's a long way to go, but heck of a start from you. Yeah. And when I looked at your lineup construction, I was like, wow, he picked players that he basically thought were going to do well. Like that we talked about on the pod, like... You know, you just nailed it all the way around is what I'm trying to say, you know?
Yeah, it was felt good about the mixture of playing guys who got eliminated and playing guys that I didn't feel I would use again. So walking away from that, I didn't feel like I wasted anyone. And I got lucky because I forgot about Justin Jefferson. And I started looking at everyone's lineups.
You don't have to admit that.
Like, oh, that's right. I'm like, why didn't I? I'm like, I didn't even think about him. And then it did.
Wait a second.
And then it worked out.
Hold on. You played Kirk Cousins.
Yeah, because I felt good about Kirk Cousins.
But you just like accidentally forgot he has Justin Jefferson.
I didn't really think about it. I was just like, I was going through receivers, and I was like, Keenan Allen, obviously. I was like, I like Christian Kirk. And I forget who my others were, but I was like, these are like
Metcalf and Hill.
Yeah, Metcalf. I was like, that feels like a no-brainer. Tyreek Hill. I was like, that is a no-brainer because he's getting out, but he'll put up yards. And then, yeah, after the fact, I saw Justin Jefferson. I was like, oh, I'm gonna get screwed because of that.
Man, that's hilarious. Yeah, you also played Barkley and Etienne, who ended up both winning. So
that, but that Barkley. Was intentional because I feel like Philly shut down Barkley last time they played, or last time being in week 14 when they played each other. So I did that for that specific reason, was that assuming they'd go on to play Philly.
Yeah. Everyone played Barkley because a lot of people didn't think they'd win.
Right. So. And I didn't want him because it was like, regardless, I don't feel good about him against Philly. And then ETN that was just, I needed a, I was like, okay, of all the guys that I think that could go out but will get me points, I like ETN over Eckler.
It's about the worst game script possible for that.
Yeah.
And he still had a decent game.
He still had a decent game.
Decent game. Jacksonville, it's like the one piece that Jacksonville, for whatever reason, just still can't figure out. And it's ETN's usage, how to deploy him, how to effectively get 100% out of him every week. They just can't figure it out.
Yeah, and for this week, like Chris said, in their defense, they were down 27-0.
Yeah, it doesn't help.
It's like I would kind of forget how to use my running back as well, because at that point, it truly does not matter.
They actually threw the ball to him a little, which they don't do ever.
He had one catch.
He had like two or three targets, which is like more than he normally gets.
Like two or three times what he usually gets.
Yeah. Yeah, especially because he can be that guy, you know, in the past game. So, but well, let's talk about that game. So that was one of the ones where Steve and I differed on, and he ends up being right. I tell you what, though, 27-0.
You were both right.
Well, here's the thing, though, guys. Guys, at 27-0, this is going to sound crazy. I'm not saying I predicted the comeback, but I didn't feel great about the way the Chargers were up 27-0.
I'm glad you said that, because then it doesn't make me sound like a douchebag coming in like, oh, I picked them to win, and I also never lost doubt. No, I like sat there at 27-0. I'm like, this feels like it could flip. It's one of the – it felt similar to the Houston Texans, Kansas City Chiefs. Obviously, completely different scenarios, but like it just felt like there were a bunch of fluky plays that got them there. And it could, and that it felt like it could fall apart at any moment.
Yeah, like the Chargers did nothing to earn that 27-0 lead. Like literally,
it should have been 40. It should have been 49 nothing.
Right, and the fact that they didn't put the nail in the coffin speaks volumes to that Chargers team and that coaching staff, which obviously ended up scapegoating Lombardi, which was probably the right guy to scapegoat, you know. But. Yeah. Man, like I didn't predict Jacksonville would come back and win that game. But at 27-0, I was telling my wife, like, the second Lawrence figures out what the Chargers are doing, like, this game's going to get closer.
Yes.
Because the Chargers were doing nothing. Literally nothing.
And so, it's funny, I forget who I saw that posted this on Twitter, but do you remember a certain 2014 game where a certain offense jumped out to a hot start and then in the second half only managed to put up 6 points and then didn't go for it on fourth and one in opponent's territory?
Was this Detroit versus Dallas in the playoffs?
Dallas and who their offensive coordinator was. Didn't that look pretty similar in how that happened? In just like the second half not being able to move the ball at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good comparison. Same offensive coordinator. So
yeah, and so it's good. It's at least good to see that hopefully they bring in someone that's worthwhile to help elevate that offense, because this is a team that should, for all intents and purposes, like they made it in the playoffs. They should have been a team that could have gone on a Super Bowl run with the health that they had and the way that things were coming together, and it was play calling and mainly play calling and just not being able to move the ball.
I would say among QBs in the NFL, Justin Herbert has the highest talent to disappointment ratio. Like the amount of talent he has versus the amount of times I watch him and I'm left disappointed has got to be the highest of any player in the NFL, because it's unbelievable what the guy's capable of, yet you just don't see it. You don't ever see it. Like it's so rare. Like those crazy throws, especially at the beginning of the year that Herbert was hitting, he has that in his body, yet it's so uncommon. It's actually crazy when you think about it. You know, we chart all of the stuff, like go throw for throw and actually find those ridiculous throws and how inconsistent he is at making them. It's not really a him problem is what I'm getting at. It's a Lombardi offense issue. And I'm kind of excited to see a potentially unlocked Justin Herbert moving forward. And that's actually one of the things I want to talk about was Staley moving on from Lombardi, probably to save his own teeth, you know?
Yeah.
He had to blame someone for that. So But Lombardi's probably the right guy to blame. I'm a big proponent of head coach continuity. While I think Staley's been terrible in his first 2 years there, I don't like firing a guy after 2 years, especially when Staley was the number one guy of his coach class. Like,
and
you think of all the teams that were hiring that year. Detroit was one of them. The Jets were one of them. Like, Staley was the most coveted guy. So you got the most coveted guy in the NFL at the time. You kind of got to give him more than 2 years, probably. So I like the fact that they're moving on from their offensive coordinator.
That, and he's shown that he can put together a very competent and successful defensive game plan.
Yeah.
So, like, it's that part of why he became a head, of why he got the recognition to become a head coach and why he was in this position. He's still good at that and has shown that he's good at that. It's not like a Matt Patricia thing where it's like, all right, you came in here and everything's kind of a disaster. You know, you can see the spots where he's there, where and why he's there. It's just, he needs help. Like most head coaches, he needs help and he needs to get the right people beside him. And hopefully they bring in someone, like I said, that can elevate that offense instead of someone who keeps it stagnant and keeps it in place.
The Chargers had a higher pass rate over expectation than the Dolphins, the Giants, the Jaguars, and still lost that game. So they were being aggressive, and they just weren't being effective with it at all.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, aggressive in that they were passing more than they were running.
Right. They didn't just try to run Eckler into the Jaguars defense over and over and be like, we're trying to salt the clock away. Like, no, they were trying to pass. They just weren't doing it effectively, which we've kind of seen all season. That's kind of been who they are.
And that's like, yeah, if you go back and look at Herbert's pass chart, I mean, there's, I think, maybe 2 to 3 targets beyond, 15, 20 yards. Everything is under 10 yards.
That's dang near every game, too.
Yeah.
It's criminal. He's Alex Smith. They've turned him into Alex Smith, effectively. Pre Tyreek Hill Alex Smith.
Alex Smith, yeah. And that's with a load of receivers that are, they're good at certain things, but speed and separation aren't necessarily, like, their calling card as a group.
Right.
And so running these short, these short routes and all of these short concepts, it either leads to incompletions or, stop for 2, 3, 4 yard gains because you just don't have guys that are necessarily elite after the catch. And that's fine. It's just that you need to run an offense that's more tailored to that.
Right. Yeah. One thing that surprised me early in this game was the Jaguars' inability to kind of figure out how to beat what the Chargers were doing. The Chargers were playing like this really aggressive zone with pressure look. Like that front seven was playing very aggressive. They were doing a lot of gap exchanges. They were blitzing on passing downs. They're basically in your face the whole game. And then the entire secondary was squatting on short routes.
Yes.
Kind of like they knew what Jackson would try to do to combat that is get the ball out quickly. Yeah, you're going to pressure the quarterback. Expect the ball out quickly. There's really two ways to beat what the Chargers were doing. One, you have to hit a deep ball and make them play off a little bit.
Yeah.
Or two, you have to put those front seven players in some type of conflict and, get your guys in space, basically. And they were able to do any of that until the second half. But if they would have figured that out in the first quarter, Steve, the Jaguars may have blown out the Chargers. Like this was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, Trevor Lawrence gift wrapped him 4 interceptions, and a couple of them were like you got fooled, and that was like they were pretty rough. Because in the beginning I was like, oh my gosh, is he really like crumbling under the pressure of the moment? Because that's all it felt like was him trying to force things, and it was dumb mistakes, preventable mistakes. And I thought, like, oh, my goodness, he's just trying to force it. The moment's too big. But like you said, second half, they settled in. They started, recognizing coverages and, taking their time instead of trying to just rush through things, which is what it felt like Trevor Lawrence was doing in the first half.
Yeah, you look at those four interceptions on their face. Like the first one, I mean, the first two actually were pretty fluky, right? So first one gets, it's a batted ball by the D-line. Now, quarterback's still responsible for that. We don't necessarily chart that as a turnover-worthy throw.
Right.
He's still responsible to know that that throwing lane is not open. But it's still fluky nonetheless. Most batted balls don't turn into, you know, interceptions that get returned for 20 yards, and then it's basically a layup for a touchdown. Or did that one go the full six? Did one of those get returned?
No.
But I think they all had good returns, but none of them made it to the end zone.
None of them made it to the end zone.
Then the second one, the receiver got completely mugged, and there was no call on that. So, and then the next two after that, I felt like Lawrence was pressing a little bit. The pressure had got to a point where it was boiling over. The moment was just too big for him at the time, and he was pressing a little bit and made two really, really bad decisions.
Yeah.
But man, he, credit to that guy. Like, he, to be able to shake off four interceptions and then come back and win a game, that's like incredible. I heard, did you hear what he said when he was coming off the field to the interviewer?
I don't think so.
I just love it. It's just speaks to such a good mentality. He said, you know, my whole team is doing everything they can to win us this game, and they're counting on me to lead them, and I can't just roll over after four bad plays and call it a game. Like, no, my job is to shake it off and get back out there and get back in the fight. And so that's what I did. He's like, I had no choice but to do that. Like, I'm not ever laying down and going to sleep, basically. So
yeah,
I thought it was just, you know, it spoke to his mentality and how strong mentally he is. Cause most quarterbacks don't bounce back from that in the same game.
And then he rewarded everyone by taking the Waffle House after.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. That's some like Friday Night Lights stuff right there. You know?
And this
Charlie's never lost on a Saturday yet.
Yeah.
In his whole career.
It's true. High school, college, NFL, undefeated on Saturdays.
Is that true?
It is.
Yeah.
It's a great stat.
Undefeated on Saturdays. He never lost a Saturday Clemson game.
Nope.
In 3 years there, he never lost a game on Saturday.
He has not.
Wow. All right, Trev.
But
I see you.
It's this evolution of, you know, being able to flip a bad first half into a good second half of why Trevor Lawrence was highly touted the way he was. I mean, this is like this season, and especially this back half of the season, we're seeing why Trevor Lawrence was hyped the way he was. All the tools, the decision making, the arm, the athleticism, it's all starting to show through as like the
confidence.
Confidence in the processing part of the game have started to become, you know, built into it. Like it's second nature. It's starting to become second nature to him as much as it can be.
Yep.
Credit to Doug Peterson too. Keeping guys engaged when they're down 27-0 going to halftime, whatever you say to them. Doug's a great coach. Like he probably got a bad beat in Philly. We'll see how it ends up in Jacksonville, but he's a great coach. He's probably one of the top coaches in the league. And you know, him and Trevor Lawrence could be a deadly pair for years to come.
Yeah. Lawrence is everything that the Eagles hoped Carson Wentz would be, honestly.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, big, big physical, gifted guy with, you know, great athleticism, great arm. Seems like a great head on his shoulders. Because everyone thought that about Carson when he was drafted.
Right.
You know, we didn't know he'd end up being a mental midget. I don't know if that's a politically correct term, but we didn't know that he would he'd have such a defeatist mentality.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, Lawrence just is like exactly who Peterson probably thought he was getting in Wentz, and he's living up to it though, where Carson didn't really, at least, so I guess far. He kind of did it early on. Yeah, so far, but probably not ever.
Right.
And I must say, well, like this, the evolution of this receiving group over the course of the season has been fun to watch as well, where now like Zay Jones is a valuable receiver and Evan Ingram is like
Ingram can ball
starting to realize the talent while also using his hands the correct way.
Well, yeah, and it's just health too. Health, he played every game this year.
Health and yeah. like they, Peterson.
The Giants just totally screwed him up. Use how they used him. Yeah, I mean, crazy yeah. how they messed that up.
Peterson recognizes it. He clearly sees the value in using Ingram, and like this back half of the season, they have made him a focal point of this offense. And you can see, like, you can just see how well this group of receivers works and meshes together. It's pretty awesome. I, you know, for a lot of castaway guys, I mean, pretty much everybody on their receiving group is kind of a castaway in some way, shape, or form. And so it's cool to see how they've, you know, become a valuable group and become a group that, you know, I'd say like at the beginning of the season, I looked as, you know, bottom seven group in the league is now, you know, performing just as well as anyone really.
Yeah, I would say the way Ingram's played down the stretch since really December, he's getting back. Like, you're seeing why he was drafted so high in the NFL.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, I'm not sure there's a linebacker in the NFL that can actually cover him one-on-one. And it's getting to the point where, like, if you want to stop him, you're going to have to commit either multiple bodies or a safety or, you know, defensive back. And what that does for your offense is crazy. Even if he stops producing because teams are committing more resources to stopping him, that's going to give you single high looks on an extraordinary amount of plays. You're going to get more one-on-ones for Zay, more one-on-ones for Kirk. I mean, that's a huge weapon if he continues to play at this level. I mean, he's been shredding teams when they've needed him to. He's had a couple duds in there for sure, but I mean, he had like 170 yards against Tennessee a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's like, how many tight ends are putting up 170 yards in a game? Like, not many.
And it segues into, obviously, Jacksonville plays Kansas City this week in Kansas City. Yeah. And kind of segues into what I think is one of the more important things for their offense is utilizing Evan Ingram against Kansas City this time. When you went back and watched like Kansas City versus Jacksonville from early this season, in the beginning of the game, Jacksonville wanted to and was trying to get Ingram involved, and Lawrence and Ingram missed on a couple. They had a couple chances, but they missed on a couple throws. Lawrence, it was mainly Lawrence missing Ingram once or twice on a couple deep balls.
Yeah, one of them was a wheel.
Yeah, after that, they kind of went away from Ingram. He didn't have, he maybe had like one target in the second half.
He had three targets in the first quarter and won the rest of the game.
Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see how they use him this time, because you could see they were trying to build that up in that game, in that first matchup. And it just, you know, for it obviously wasn't hitting, and they moved on to other things. And it'll be interesting because I think they know they have a mismatch there against Kansas City with Ingram. And so I think he needs to get double-digit targets in this game for them to stay in it, because this is a matchup that bodes kind of well for Jacksonville. Like, if there's a team that Jacksonville can stick with, if they can keep their offense moving and not fall into what happened against the Chargers, the Kansas City defense can be you can move the ball on them.
I'm probably not going that far, Steve. I think Kansas City should roll through them pretty easily, personally. I don't think anyone on that Jacksonville line is going to block Chris Jones.
That's going to be the issue for them. It's not so much the secondary as it is the offensive line versus defensive pass rush.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what they do. So the Chiefs have been at some point, I forget exactly what week, they basically – Legarius Sneed had been their slot corner all through the season, and at some point they moved McDuffie to the slot and put Sneed outside.
Yep.
But now you get in week 18 when they played the Raiders, they had Sneed basically just follow around Adams for a good amount. Now you got Christian Kirk and the Jaguars. Do they kick Sneed back into the slot and have McDuffie play outside? It'll be interesting to see how the Chiefs approach the matchup, especially with the evolution of the Jaguars passing attack. If they don't, Kirk could have a great game against McDuffie in the slot. Just not that he's been terrible as a rookie, but just nothing special either so far.
Yeah.
Lawrence could target him. Ingram's going to have his matchups, and maybe it's a quieter Zay Jones and Marvin Jones game. But yeah, the secondary is not the main issue. It's going to be that offensive defensive line matchup.
Yeah, and I think that Kansas City probably ultimately ends up winning, but I think Jacksonville has a chance to stay in this if they can move the ball on offense. Their defense is another story. When they played Kansas City earlier in the season, they were just toying with Jacksonville's linebackers. They were just sending crossing routes behind those guys all day long and forcing them to make a play, and they couldn't. And you know, Mahomes picked him apart that way. They got to Mahomes once and turned him over, but for the most part, they were just reading off those linebackers and forcing them to make a play. It'll be interesting though, because Jacksonville did play double the amount of cover two against Kansas City than they normally play. They ran 30% cover two in their matchup against Kansas City. They usually run about 15% cover two. So it'll be interesting to see if they stick with that. Because when they ran cover two, Mahomes completed about 75% of his passes for, you know, it was 88 yards and only about 6 yards an attempt and an ADOT of 3.3. So, like, they minimized him, but they still were efficient moving the ball. Almost every drop back turned into some sort of positive yardage, except for, I think, two incompletions.
Yeah, that was pre the dynamic running back duo for Kansas City breaking out too, right?
Yeah.
Pacheco and McKinnon hadn't really been the guys yet. I know Pacheco played a lot in that game, but
yeah,
McKinnon didn't really.
That was Edwards-Helaire was getting most of the snaps at the time.
Yeah.
And McKinnon offers an even bigger matchup because between having McKinnon running and coming out of the backfield and then operating Kelsey over the middle, forcing Aluakon and Devin Lloyd to step up and make plays and cover those guys. That's what Kansas City wants. Kansas City wants those guys to make mistakes and force them to make a play.
Yep, I think Kadarius Toney has a chance to be a factor in this game.
Yeah, if he actually plays. He just doesn't play a lot of snaps.
This was,
it may just have been saving him for the playoffs type thing, but
this was his break.
Yeah, they had the extra week.
He's in.
Right.
So right. he has experience against Jacksonville and kind of lighting him up a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Mecole Hardman also didn't play a ton in week 18, his first game back from IR. Have to admit, he was pretty heavily involved early in the season. I don't know why they would go away from that. Not using
Hardman?
Yeah.
They just said a couple days ago they're going away from it.
Oh, they did.
Yeah, they said that he's looked rough at practice and they're going away from Mecole. Like, I don't even think he dresses this game.
Huh, that's crazy. Well, I guess McKinnon's kind of filled that in. Toney can fill in that other part. So they definitely can replace it, but he definitely was effective early. They also obviously didn't struggle to score points even when he was gone. I guess the main receiver, you'll have Kelsey, Juju in the slot, and Toney, Justin Watson. Sky Moore probably still doesn't play, really. This could be a big Juju game. I mean, if you want to attack the Jaguars, the slot is where you do it.
Yeah, slotting over the middle, and that's what.
Right.
That's when Juju did that against him last time. He had a decent game, and he was operating pretty well in space against their corners and their linebackers. So.
Yeah. I mean, they move guys around a lot, probably more than any team in the NFL. Like, they probably all play a good chunk of slot snaps, all their receivers.
Yeah.
But yeah, Juju is definitely the primary guy there. They should. I mean, yeah, I don't. Kansas City's offense shouldn't have an issue with this defense.
And that's what I think ultimately, you know, probably wins out. But I think it's going to be a shootout. I think it'll be kind of a back and forth game, and it'll be who outlasts who. And unfortunately, I think the Jaguars are going up against the team that can outlast anyone at any time.
Yeah. I will say this, Steve. I do think if I'm Jacksonville, I'd rather play Kansas City than Cincinnati right now.
I completely.
Oh, no.
Really?
What? Yes, Kansas City is far and away the best team in the AFC.
They maybe top to bottom, but Cincinnati is the best quarterback in the league right now. Burrow's playing far and away above anybody else. It's not even close.
And I just think that Jacksonville would want to see Kansas City just because of the ability to move the ball against their defense. That's the only reason. I don't think Jacksonville's defense matches up well with Kansas City's offense, but I think that Kansas City's defense is more susceptible against the specifically against Jacksonville compared to Cincinnati.
I just want to avoid Burrow at all costs. I think the Bills are in big trouble this week.
I'd love to play that offensive line the Bengals are trotting out now.
Hasn't mattered yet.
Lost two more guys though.
Well, Jonah and then the other guy, he was a backup anyways, right? And yeah, the former starters replacing him. So
here, let's jump to that game. So Buffalo Bills beat the Miami Dolphins, outlasted them 34-31.
Barely beat them.
And then the Bengals outlasted Baltimore after preventing a last-second touchdown. And now the matchup that, you know, got suspended and ultimately canceled a few weeks ago, we get the rematch that everybody, I think, was looking forward to. And, yeah, it's – I'd say two teams that are coming in different states as far as where their quarterback is at right now.
Very much so. Allen, he's starting to look like rookie second-year Josh Allen again. And I don't think that elbow is fully greased up.
It's just a weapons issue. And we've talked about that, I think, a couple times. Their weapons are all – outside of Diggs are just like these downfield targets. And it seems like Allen just like feels that and just feels the need to chuck it deep over and over and over again.
Well, it's a decision-making thing more than a weapons issue to me.
Well, I'm saying it goes there. I could like, if all right, Diggs is covered, but maybe he's double covered. Maybe he's just locked up, whatever. Gabe Davis is just like, all he really does is run deep routes, different vertical routes. And it seems like Allen just like defaults into making that his decision over and over again.
Yeah.
Which can work, because if you hit them, they're huge plus EV plays, but obviously they also can get you in a lot of trouble. And be like, just Cole Beasley as your chain mover only gets you so far.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, you just said yourself though, that they have a bunch of downfield guys. That means they need Cole Beasley.
No, I'm not saying they don't need Cole Beasley, but it also just only gets you so, like, Cole Beasley's not going to win you the game, though, either.
Yeah, like, if you could add
Tyler Boyd can win the Bengals a game in certain situations.
I see where you're going from. Like you said, we've talked about it where the nosedive from talent-wise as far, or I guess usefulness-wise as receiver from Diggs to, like, Davis – like, Davis hasn't really realized any sort of intermediate route-winning type of receiver. He's been mostly just down the field, late-breaking routes, because he's, you know, he's fast and he can push a corner. He can push a corner and force him to flip his hips.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Stephon Diggs is phenomenal in pretty much every aspect.
Though. Yes, definitely.
They need to find ways to get him more involved in the short parts of the field. But maybe they're missing Dable more than people are talking about. You know,
yeah,
maybe the play calling. Like, Dable was able to scheme it up, and these tendencies that Josh Allen's playing with again. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, these are huge problems, and it goes beyond personnel. Like, look at some of these fumbles he had in the pocket this week. Like, you just got to be like, what are you doing? What are you actually doing right now? He looked broken.
He didn't run much. And I don't know if that was a planned thing or what, especially in a close game, it's not uncommon for us to see Allen just like start taking the game over. And that really wasn't happening at all this week.
Yeah, you're right. There wasn't a ton of scramble, and even on designed runs, you didn't really see one until kind of the fourth quarter for Maryland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's credit to the Daboll thing that you said, because look at what Daniel Jones is doing and his ability to limit turnovers this year compared to what he was doing prior in his career. And then Josh Allen before, or I guess not before Daboll, but Josh Allen earlier in his career, and then now not having Daboll, he's back to turning the ball over. So I wonder I assume Daboll has influence in helping these quarterbacks make smart decisions, maintain the ball, things like that.
Yeah, it seems to me like he's got to have a lot more. Like, that discussion probably needs to be had more. It's like how much Daboll is actually affecting. Yeah. I haven't done like a finite analysis of how the play calling's changed necessarily, but it does seem like everything they're doing is scheming up big throws.
Yeah.
Like, even like one of the fumbles Allen had this week was like a max protection, two tight end, wing left. And, you know, he had 7-8 pass blockers, and he's just holding the ball forever, waiting for a guy to come open. That type of stuff probably needs to change. So I know Cincinnati's not like they don't have any elite players on their defense, but they don't have any bad players on their defense either. And Cincinnati, I think, can probably expose those tendencies even better than Miami did. You know, they might not force as many turnovers, but they're going to put Josh into positions where he's uncomfortable a lot more. And so I think I'm concerned about the Bills this week, guys. I think I'm probably actually going to pick the Bengals in this game.
Yeah, I was going to pick the Bengals too, despite not liking the offensive line.
Yeah. One note on the difference in receiving core. It's easy to say, well, look what the Bengals have with Chase and Higgins and Boyd, and the Bills just have Diggs and then Davis. Well, so Diggs is making $20-something million a year. Like, the Bengals have Chase and Higgins on rookie contracts. It's pretty easy to make that work when you got those guys and Burrow on rookie contract, you know?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
So they're just at different stages of their franchise development.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Cincinnati's one of the top half of the league in deep passing against. They defend the deep pass pretty well, and they have 7 interceptions on it and only 22 receptions on 69 targets. So they've defended the deep ball pretty well this year. So it'll be interesting to see how, if they try to utilize Dawson Knox a little bit more and try and, you know, it's just like you said, they're more sum of their parts than they are individualized defense. So it'll be interesting to see where Ken Dorsey tries to pick them apart a little bit. And I think it's the line, like trying to work against their linebackers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even Knox though is a vertical threat. Yeah. Like he's a vertical running tight end, vertical route running tight end.
But
so
I'd like to see them use him over the middle a little bit more, because I think he's a big body and he's athletic. I feel like he should be able to provide value there. They just don't use him there a lot.
No, yeah. The game. I don't think this game comes down to Burrow versus Allen, who puts up the most points. It's the Bills' defensive line versus the Bengals' offensive line, and can they limit Burrow enough through that to the point where their offense can outscore? Like, I didn't think the last game would be high scoring, and I don't think this one will either, unless it's just the Bills can't get pressure on Burrow, and Burrow just totally lights them up.
The Bills' pass rush is weird because they go through stretches since they've lost Vaughn where, and I'm talking within a game even, they'll go through stretches where they're getting pressure at, like, it seems like every other drop back. And then there were stretches in this Miami game where Thompson had all day to throw.
Yeah.
It was weird. But then, like, on the next drive, he'd get pressured 3 drop backs in a row. So it's like, I think the Bills are going to have to scheme up pressure more than they like to, because we've talked about this a lot, Steve. They love getting pressure with 4. If they get pressure with 4, that secondary kind of just comes together. If not, the defense has been very vulnerable since Miller's gone down. So that, I think you're right, Chris. That's going to be a pretty big battle to watch, is that the Bills D-line versus the Bengals O-line.
Yeah, they were pretty middle of the pack. This pack, we concerned with pressure, but yeah, over since like week 15, they're below 30%, which is pretty low compared. It's one of the lowest of all the remaining playoff teams, at least.
Yeah, and when they had Vaughn, they were leading the league in pressure rate with a 4-man rush.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Big time change. It totally changes the complexion of that secondary.
Yeah, and like you said, Brett, you can see it at times too. You can just see their front four will get stonewalled for drives at a time. They're starting to have to use some more sim pressures and bringing Edmonds and
Milano
a little bit more, which is not what they want to do because they like those two.
Right.
They like those two in pass coverage. They like those two having sitting and guarding the middle of the field. And so, you know, having to use those guys in different sim pressure looks and trying to shake things up a little bit to get pressure, having to waste those guys, not necessarily waste them, but use them in the pass rush as opposed to in coverage. I think if they can force them to have to bring pressure with multiple people, Cincinnati can start to dice him up, because that's where Joe Burrow thrives is against the blitz.
Yeah. Well, and to that point, like, they had four sacks against the Dolphins. Two of them were Matt Milano coming up to A-gap on like a linebacker twist. The other one was Taron Johnson coming off of a slot blitz.
Yep.
And Skylar Thompson just didn't ID it. Now, Taron Johnson didn't get the sack, but he pushed Skyler right into a defensive. I think it was Boogie Basham maybe on the play. They're definitely having to scheme more of that, and we've seen Burrow shred the blitz. So
yes.
If they can't get home with four, then I think Burrow is going to have a very easy, comfortable day back there. So let's talk Dallas, San Francisco.
Yes.
Mostly because I want to get to Brock Purdy, because I have a bigger overarching theme I want to get into a little bit too before we get off. But so Dallas, San Francisco pretty much destroyed Seattle. That was the only blowout of the week.
Yeah.
In like a quarter and a half too. It did it in like 1.5 quarters.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Even though it was a blowout, Seattle still came to play in the first half. They kind of impressed me in a lot of ways. Which is a good reminder that playoff football is different than regular season football. All these teams that are playing deserve to be here for the most part, except Seattle. Ironically, they're the ones that got beat pretty badly. But every game was close. So even though, you know, even when you're confident about a game, most of these games ended up being nail biters in some regard.
Yeah.
We need to fix this ineligible man downfield rule, though. And Seattle got hit. That felt like the turning point of the game, that first one they got in the red zone.
One of them was completely erroneous, too.
Yeah, it's just like, if it doesn't affect the play at all, like, why are we calling this so ticky-tack? Like, just, there's got to be some subjectivity. Like, use your brain a little bit of, okay, yeah. does this matter?
The first one you're talking about, I'm like, there was no screen. There was no RPO on the play.
I was pretty confident.
Yeah, the lineman thought the play was over and was going to celebrate, not realizing Geno hadn't thrown yet.
Yeah. It's just
had zero consequence to the play. Yeah. I agree that they're also like with the technology we have at our disposal, like, you'd be able to just see if the guy's actually 2 yards past the line of scrimmage.
Well, I mean,
even if it's not in the locker.
But even making it black and white though, Chris, would be like so much better, because you can't tell me that one of those he was actually 2 yards beyond the line of scrimmage. He was clearly like a half yard.
Right.
At the time of the throw. And the ref probably like looked at him, then looked at the throw and was like, oh, he's, or maybe looked at the throw, then looked at him.
Right.
And then threw the flag. It's just, it looked like they were looking for penalties almost.
And the threshold is 2 yards, right? That's kind
it's of technically one. It's one with a ghost one.
Right.
So it's, I don't know. It's,
yeah, just don't, you know, if it's a simple fade route to the back of the end zone, which I think it might have been, was what they were doing, like, just don't, it's not worth calling. Yeah. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant to the play.
And it's, I obviously, a point of emphasis this year. And There was one I've seen a couple this year where an offensive lineman just kicked someone's butt, and they get called for illegal man down the field just for like
just pancaking him and throwing him past a yard,
blocking too well at the point of attack.
Right. And well, that's the rule. If you're engaged, it doesn't apply, right? If you're engaged with a defender,
not supposed to.
But if you pancake a guy at the line of scrimmage and then standing over him at a yard pass,
that's dumb.
It's hopefully I really hope that next year this gets flattened out a little bit, because this year it's been.
Seattle had like three or four, and they don't even like they're not even a heavy like RPO team. So
happens in the weirdest scenarios where it's like, okay, I don't. Do we really like you said?
It's almost like they were trying to like create justice for Seattle getting a bunch of favorable calls the week before.
It seems
so ticky tack. That was the thing that was weird. It was just like what? Like,
just ask yourself: is there a competitive advantage here? And if the answer is no, don't throw the flag.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is basically what Dean Blandino said when he was on the broadcast. He's like, I would not have thrown either of those flags. So long story short, though, San Francisco balled out. They're taking on a team this week at home that just probably put the end of Tom Brady's career on full display in the Dallas Cowboys. But I wanted to talk about Brock Purdy. I wanted to talk about Skylar Thompson. And I want to talk about Tyler Huntley.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay.
These are three backup quarterbacks that were all drafted late in the draft. And from a team building perspective, how much value is there to just throw in darts at these types of QBs?
A ton.
It seems like it, right? Like these guys all competed, like legitimately competed in playoff football games.
Yeah.
I mean, Huntley almost pulled off a huge upset against the Bengals. Thompson almost did one against the Bills. And then Purdy, his team's he didn't have to do much, but he's giving more to that offense than Jimmy G does. Brock Purdy's creative ability, his ability to make plays outside the pocket, those are things Jimmy G didn't offer that offense. And Purdy's almost like unlocked another aspect of this offense. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But all these guys were later picks, and it's just like when you look at the QB deficit in the league, there is a QB shortage. Like some teams' backup situations are so bad that if they were required to play a backup, they wouldn't win a single game.
Yes.
So how does this happen? How do we have three third string QBs, or I guess backup QBs, playing in the playoffs, playing well, and then there's some teams that just have nothing there, and they don't ever really do anything to fix it either. It's not like there's an expense associated with this. You know, the last pick in the draft fetched the 49ers Brock Purdy.
Yep.
They're paying him like less than $1 million this year.
Yep. Just always be cycling through your quarterback room is really the key. Like if you didn't, San Francisco done a good job of this over the, I mean, Nick Mullins, CJ Beathard have all spent time looking good in this offense because Kyle Shanahan creates a great offense. But, they've constantly cycled through their quarterback situation. The Eagles have done this well over the years. Just keep cycling. Like, there's certain backups, I think, the Case Keenums of the world, that are useful on certain teams where if your starter went down, you're a playoff team, you're just trying to keep it alive. But there's a ton of other backups that just – we know what they are, you know. Like, they're cycling these rookies, these first get 1 year, got year out guys, just keep cycling them through and see if you can find, a diamond in the rough. And they don't have to be a superstar. They just need to be functional.
And I think that there's a lot of credit that goes to how NFL offenses are built now, especially in the last couple of years compared to, early 2010s, 2000s, where you can scheme offenses to be less dependent on a quarterback's decision making abilities. That's what Kyle Shanahan has done. It's what Mike McDaniel is trying to do. Like that's, and then with Baltimore's offense, it is a lot of one read option. Like that's what Roman builds his offense for Huntley. That's kind of what they do. And being able to take a lot of that, figuring out the game and figuring out defenses and having the offense and the structure of the offense figure that out for them, that's where I think there's value in bringing these quarterbacks in, because you just need a guy that has – I mean, you don't just need him. There's obviously a lot into it. But by bringing them into an offense that has developed weapons and a developed scheme that can scheme guys open, you can bring in a guy that you just need him to be accurate and you just need him to be calm in the pocket. And that's what Purdy's doing. Skylar Thompson, he's played, what, 3-4 games now? He's kind of figured it out. Go ahead, Brett.
Perfect segue to what I actually wanted to talk about. So Bill Parcells has the famous QB criteria that he looks for in a quarterback. This is pretty famous doctrine. It's been written about in several books. But here's the baseline of his doctrine for drafting a quarterback and allowing him to play on your team. Mm-hmm. One is be a 3-year starter in college. Two, be a senior in college and also graduate from college. Start 30 games at the college level and win 23 games. So when you talk about comfortability in the pocket, what gives you that comfortability in anything in life? It's experience, yeah, right? It's repetition, knowing. Well, guess what? All three of the guys we're talking about right now, they were all 3-year starters. They were all seniors in college. I don't know if they actually graduated or not. I didn't take the time to look that up. They all started 30-plus games. Actually, all three of them started 35 games or more, and they all won 23 games at the college level. We used to make fun of this doctrine because it's like a bunch of arbitrary numbers, right?
Right.
It's like, well, who decides 30 games is the best number? Like, why is that a thing?
The number doesn't really matter. The point of it all is what you're there's not a hard number. There's a range.
Yeah.
Where there clearly is a boost in possible NFL success.
Yeah, it's that experience. Like, these guys have all they've seen battle. They've all been at war. They've have a lot of reps under their belt. They've had a lot of things thrown at them. They've carried a lot of weight on their shoulders, especially guys like Tyler Huntley. Actually, all three of them, really. They played for teams that were underwhelming in their conference but overperforming for what that team brand was.
Yes.
Which comes with a lot of pressure. Brock Purdy was the Trevor Lawrence draft class. He was, like, I think the second QB recruit that year and picked Iowa State for whatever godforsaken reason and played insanely well as a freshman. And, you know, that pressure started to mount from there. So I think there's something to be said that, like, I think we – like, I know that I'm going to think about that a little bit more when we're going through tape this year looking at college prospects. It's like there's a lot of guys – I mean, Chris and I were just talking yesterday, Jaren Hall and Clayton Tune and – some of these dudes that Max Duggan, like, how many of them check these boxes, I wonder? Because that experience is important, man. Like, Skylar Thompson, like, you would never thought that dude was a 7th-round pick on Sunday's game.
No.
The confidence and swagger he was playing with for a guy that, like, had, like, 6 months ago, he had no idea if he'd played in the NFL.
Yeah. Right.
He had to make a roster, for God's sakes. And he, like, it's crazy. And he took how many hits in that game and got up every single time, ready to go.
You could make the argument they win that game if, because, like, Tyreek and a lot of the other offensive players pretty much looked checked out in the beginning of that game and, like, weren't really, you know, didn't seem like it was, like, they really thought they had a shot.
Right.
And then in the second half, they're like, oh, like, we've really got a chance here, and seemed to pick it up. Like, I wonder if that crept into their mind at all. But yeah, they definitely had Skylar Thompson did not look like a 7th-round rookie. The whole experience thing, it makes you think, like, we hear all the time that backups get on teams because they have experience in the NFL. Why not take a guy that's have experience at college where the level of play is still very high and, like, a lot of the pressures are similar? Like, do the Cardinals need a Colt McCoy on their team versus a guy like Skylar Thompson or Brock Purdy? Like, you don't need – it doesn't have to be NFL experience to be good experience.
Right.
And I still – like, this isn't – like, I think a lot of this is built around that, like, the way they're off the offense – that is the way the offense is built that they're playing in. Because I don't think that this is a universal rule for every team of, like, hey –
no, yeah. A bad offense is a bad offense.
Right, but I think there are offenses that – there's more value to do this than there is to do it in other places. And, like, Miami's a good example. San Francisco.
All three of them are, actually.
Yeah, all three of them are a good example. Detroit is another example that's coming along. And it's just going to show how much and how important offensive structure is, and just that, yes, it's valuable to have a guy like Patrick Mahomes and a guy like Josh Allen. Those are obviously the guys that are, you know, they're aliens and they can win you games on the, you know, on their own backs. But I think that we're starting to see that you can scheme a good offensive structure and get the weapons around them to where now it's more feasible to win a win games without the superstar quarterback.
Yeah. I mean, it's scheme that creates identity. Like, these are all three of these quarterbacks we're talking about, they're in team situations that have an identity. They know what their scheme is. I know the Dolphins regime is new to Miami, but that scheme and identity was already created in San Francisco, and they're just imparting that in Miami. They've brought in Tyreek Hill to assist with that. So, like, yeah, culture, identity, ecosystem, it's all very important, clearly. When you drop a guy in the mix with this kind of experience, it kind of just goes, you know? Like, Huntley, he's not Lamar Jackson, but he's 85% of Lamar Jackson, probably. Like, he's impressed me every time he's had to play for Lamar. I'm not going to say every game, but he's had moments where, like, this guy can play.
It's mostly the decision making that is, like, the difference. Like, Lamar just has, like, he's, you know, a tenth of, you know, half a second faster on knowing what to do. Maybe Lamar doesn't reach out that ball over the goal line that Huntley did, and it gets returned for a fumble, like, stuff like that. It's like that's the major difference between a guy like Huntley and Lamar, which can come, you know, more experience will help that.
Yeah.
And to, like, back to the Dallas-San Francisco, talking about San Francisco, like, Brock Purdy didn't play that good of a game against Seattle.
He did have to do much.
He made some poor decisions, some decisions that could have come back to bite him. But guess what? They have five of the best weapons in the NFL on their own offense, and those guys went out and made plays. And that's the wiggle room that Brock Purdy gets to play with. And within that offensive structure and because of the weapons they have, he doesn't have to be perfect. He doesn't have to be lights out every Sunday for this team to win a game. And it showed on Sunday. He had a couple throws where it looked like throws, either plays should have been made out of the defense, but they had a guy who made a play for them, and it flipped it on its head. And that,
yeah, he had a, there was a deeper shot, not, I forget how far exactly, but a vertical route to Debo that was, a lot of people were lauding as an awesome throw, but it was an inches away from being picked off. Like, if the Seattle, yeah, like, that was, it was not probably where he should have thrown the ball.
Right.
But the ball sneaks through. But that's all he just needs to either keep getting lucky like that or just not make mistakes, too many mistakes. Anyway, they can get away with a couple, but
and then there's,
just keep it limited.
And the tail is there too. Like, the escape that he had on the almost touchdown to Ayuk towards the end of the game, he has that escapability in the pocket. He's very good on,
I mean, his first two touchdowns were of that variety.
Yeah, checkdowns that, like, Jimmy Garoppolo wouldn't have gotten to.
The checkdown to McCaffrey's not even part of the route scheme there. He's literally pass blocking. Purdy makes, like, three guys miss in the backfield, rolls out, right, sees McCaffrey just standing there, flips it to him.
Right.
The and next one to Mitch, same exact thing.
Yeah, it was the exact
running,
same
literally
thing.
Running for his life, makes several guys miss, drops it off. They really just need him to keep creating like that and also take care of the football.
Right.
He doesn't have to make big time throws or wild throws, you know.
Yeah. You're not containing the best running back, best fullback, top three tight end, and top wide receiver duo in the league for 7 seconds on a play.
Right.
Forever.
And that is the interesting, that's the matchup of the week for this game, is Dallas's defense. I believe they had Diggs travel with Evans pretty much on,
not into the slot was the only spot that I saw.
Like, he was tracking him side to side as far as when he was outside receiver, I'm pretty sure. Right.
For the most part, yeah.
I'm interested to see how Dallas matches up against San Francisco because they have so many weapons, and Dallas, their second cornerback has been an issue. And just
also,
defending in general has been kind of an issue later in the season outside of whoever Diggs is covering.
So they made a big change in their defense this week. They moved Deron Bland, the rookie corner that had been playing in the slot, yep, to outside corner, and basically had Javon Kearse play slot corner, who also got banged up. Who knows how bad, maybe they were up by so much they just said, not worth you going back in.
Yeah.
And he's fine. But that's a big change. And I'm curious what they'll do this week. Because Nashon Wright wasn't even active. Trayvon Mullen wasn't active. They were both playing their other outside corner spot in week 18.
Yeah.
Xavier Rhodes didn't really play. They signed him last week. So, I mean, they're not equipped in the secondary to cover this, and they already are making adjustments to try to plug holes as it is. And if Kearse is also not in a good shape, that is not good.
Yeah, ever since Brown went down in the backfield, they've been scrambling to try to figure out how to cover up that second corner.
Yep.
And this is the one matchup of the week that does it. They didn't play each other this season. Everybody else, I mean, Cincinnati and Buffalo almost played each other. We're starting to play each other, but this is the one where they don't. And the closest match, like, I went and watched San Fran versus Las Vegas, because Las Vegas runs similar coverage schemes to Dallas. And San Francisco, they used a lot of screens, and they used a lot of over routes, deep overs, to try to confuse linebackers and safeties. I think Dallas's linebackers are a little bit better than at Las Vegas, but it'll be interesting to see if they just are picking apart with Debo and Ayuk in the slot and then Kittle over the middle.
Kittle over the middle.
I know.
Say that like five times fast.
Kittle over the middle.
Kittle over the middle. Kittle over the middle. Kittle over the middle. Kittle over the middle. Boom. Got it. Yeah, so who are we taking in Dallas, San Francisco?
I'm taking the Niners. I think they can limit Parsons enough, do enough to slow him down. And I don't trust Dallas to use him effectively, and I don't trust Dallas to not give Zeke basically the same number of carries as Pollard in this game.
What?
And that'll ultimately be their downfall, I think.
Yeah, Dallas is – I think San Francisco wins. I think for Dallas's offense to stay in this, because I think that's the biggest – I think that is a question I have, is if Dallas, what Dak can do against an elite defense like this. And it'll be interesting to see if they start utilizing motion and get Hufanga and those linebackers to move and slide a little bit and get them off, you know, not comfortable. If they can't do that, I think it's a long day for Dallas, but I think ultimately San Francisco wins either way. I just think they have too many weapons and their defense is too good, and I don't trust Dallas to beat San Fran.
Yeah, I think I told Chris on Tuesday that I was going to pick Dallas just to be contrarian for the pod. But because, you know, after the Monday night game, you kind of felt like Dallas was almost like this invincible team.
Yeah.
But then you sit back and you realize they just stomped on the carcass of Brady and that Bucks.
The Bucks looks like they have all year.
Yeah, left which is clueless self, and Todd Bowles looking like he's never watched a football game before. Like, it was just, you know, they were doing what just had to be done. They were putting the animal down. You know, the animal had already been hit by the car. So I, the more I evaluated that game, more I was like, I don't think Dallas did much to impress me in this. So I'm going San Francisco all the way. I believe in what they got going on. Purdy, you know, I've been waiting for this breakdown from him where he's just going to start chucking the ball into harm's way. And, you know, he had one that was close this week, but still nothing too scary from him. And if anything, he's really done a good job of obfuscating pressure and just mitigating what defenses are trying to do. So I'm pretty confident with the 49ers, and I'm taking them.
Yeah, I agree.
Cha-cha. We didn't actually pick Cincy Buffalo. Do we want to do that really quick before we get to the last game? I think everyone is picking Cincy, no? Chris, you're picking Cincy. I'm picking Cincy.
I'm going to pick Buffalo to be.
Okay.
I'm going to do the contrarian. I'm going to pick Buffalo. I think they can win. I think if Josh Allen.
Oh, they definitely can win. Yeah.
Josh Allen can do a turnover or less. Buffalo wins this game.
One or less turnovers,
and they win the game. I think.
Okay, yeah, I think he'll have at least two. I think he'll have one lollipop interception down the field, and then I think he'll have a sack fumble in there as well. Personally.
Yeah, and I'm praying it doesn't happen. The last game of the week, though.
Yes, the Giants at Chris's Philadelphia Eagles. Woohoo!
Chris, how are you feeling about this game?
Oh, they're gonna smash the Giants. They're
confident swagger. I love it.
Yeah. I was talking to my dad's a Giants fan. I was talking to him last night, and he's like, "You don't think we have a chance at all?" I was like, "No, I'm sorry, Dad, but they don't have a chance."
Did he call you a biased hack?
No, he didn't. He's like, "Oh man," I think it'll be good. You know, I say they're going to smash him, but like you said earlier, Brett, this is the playoffs. A lot of games end up closer than we think they do. So, yeah, that's definitely possible. But not taking anything away from Daniel Jones, what he did, he looked awesome last week. But it was against arguably the worst defense in the league.
Yes.
Definitely one of the worst in the league.
Yes.
And Daboll knew that and said, you know, go out. And we're just going to throw all over you. If they play man, just take off and run. And he just kept doing. He just did it over and over and over again. I don't see how the Giants slow down the Eagles' offense. There's no. All right, we just got to limit Justin Jefferson and T.J. Hockenson will fall down, and we don't have to worry about the other two guys running around. Like you use A.J. Brown, Devonta Smith, Dallas Goedert. Like they should not be able to match up with the Eagles, assuming. And all of this depends on Hurts' health, obviously. He's not on the injury report, so that's a good thing. Doesn't mean that he, you know, is going to be running around like he normally does. But that's a big, big factor in all of this, of course.
Yeah.
Did you say Justin Jefferson, Chris?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny because I was under the impression that he actually played for the Giants last week. And I thought him and Hodgins switched numbers. That didn't happen?
They got the wrong jerseys in the wrong locker room somehow.
Well, listen, only the Minnesota Vikings could make Isaiah Hodgins look like Justin Jefferson.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, nothing against Mr. Hodgins.
Hodgins is a solid player.
He's had a fantastic breakout campaign for pick.
Yeah, he reminds me so much of Travis Fulgham for the Eagles a few years ago. Like, looked like they found a dot. A little bit
more twitched up than Fulgham, but yeah.
Yeah. Similar, you know, journey they're going on.
Yes.
And doesn't mean that he'll end up being totally out of the league in a year or two, but
Hodgins would look nice on the Bills right now. Holy
God. Would. You very much would.
Yeah.
Yeah. They need that big possession guy who doesn't have to only be winning downfield to catch the ball.
Yes.
Going back and watching Giants Philly, not the Week 18 matchup, but the one prior, I don't think Philly really thinks they can lose to the Giants. The way they played that game, I think Philly knew they were going to win. I think the way they were running their routes and the way they were just throwing deep balls at a higher rate than they normally do, like they were willing to just take chances against New York because they knew that they had better athletes. And when New York was on offense, they couldn't run the ball with Saquon. Daniel Jones was constantly under pressure, and passing the ball, he did well, but the problem was that he was pressured all the time and he could only complete short passes. And that's where Philly's defense thrives, is keeping everything in front of him, bringing you down at the point of attack and minimizing yak. And that's what I worry is that without Daniel Jones having his ability to scramble outside of the pocket, which Philly did well to mitigate earlier in the year, and then if Saquon struggles, who steps up for him? That's the problem. That's
a
question.
Leonard Williams did miss that first matchup, right?
Dory Jackson definitely did.
Dory Jackson.
Dory I'm pretty sure Williams did, because I think
he did as well. Yeah,
Miles Sanders went berserk in that game, right?
The way, yeah, the whole run, they ran for like 200, or they ran for some ridiculous high number of rushing yards. The team as a whole,
the Giants,
yeah, they're much Giants are much healthier than they were that first time.
They're
but they're also the linebackers are an issue for the Giants this week.
Yeah, Jared Davis.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem.
So it'll be interesting to see what they do, because against Minnesota, they trotted out six or seven defensive backs.
They've done that all year.
They know their linebackers are an issue. And I wonder if Philly will use a lot of two tight end heavy personnel
to force them into
to keep their base defense on the field, and if they'll just attack Goddard and those guys against their linebackers.
And if the Giants don't, then they run it down their throats like they did.
Yeah,
in week four or whatever that was.
I think Philly knows they have more weapons, and like I said, I think their secondary was super banged up. It was at the point in the year where I don't even know if they had four defensive backs healthy. No.
They've got like seven guys that now have playing experience because of how banged up they've been across the year.
It was bad. And I think that there's obviously some to that, but still, even with the guys that are coming healthy, Adoree Jackson adds value, but they still don't have a guy that can match up consistently against both Brown and Smith. And Philly knows that. And they also,
Adoree's not stopping either of those guys though. Let's be honest.
You're right.
No, but it helps.
He's their best chance.
Yeah, this would be a one of the worst losses in Eagles history if they lost this game somehow. So they're not losing this game. The Giants are just the talent level is just not there yet.
Any type of goodwill that Sirianni built up with Philly fans would be immediately out the window if you lost to the Giants in the playoffs.
As the one seed it's not. And this is the matchup they could only ask for outside of Seattle beating San Francisco somehow. Yeah.
And even then, I think that this one is better suited for them than playing Seattle.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Yeah. There was a part of me was thinking that when Seattle was up, I was like, I think I'd rather have the Giants play them next week.
And
people are obsessing over Daniel Jones' performance a little bit when it was the Vikings defense was
terrible.
Terrible. Just so bad.
Daniel Jones isn't going to be able to scramble or run the ball. At least I don't think he'll be able to scramble or run the ball against Philly the way he did against Minnesota. And that's what helped break this game open was that they need that run game for their offense to get going and to get comfortable. And that's what Philly did last time, is they stopped him at the point. They stopped him in the run game and then forced them to start airing the ball out. And that's where the Giants start getting uncomfortable, is putting them into predictable passing situations.
Yeah, they're not a passing team. They've only been a positive pass rate over expectation team against the same team, the Vikings, when they play them each time.
Yeah.
That's not what they want to do.
Yeah.
I think he could get off some scrambles for sure, though. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how much the Eagles are worried about that. If they put a spy on him and just say, you just follow Daniel Jones around or not, or what they end up
doing. Spies don't work in the NFL.
They did a lot of seven-man fronts, five-man pass rush against the Giants in week 14. And that seemed to help contain Jones, because they were able to get into their base defense and just run their four defensive backs and trust their linebackers in coverage. And with five guys, they were containing Jones well. And I think that the Eagles are very good at that. Their defensive tackles are very good at maintaining their lanes in the pass rush. And they also have two fast guys that can contain on the outside. And I think that's what helps to mitigate Daniel Jones' scrambling situations.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, they should be used to the read option conflict game, because they play against it in practice every day. So,
you would hope. Right?
All right, so let's pick it out. I think everyone picking the Eagles here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. If Darius Slayton and Isaiah Hodgins combined for over 200 yards receiving against the Eagles, I'll eat crow, but I don't see that happening. And without that, I don't see the Giants having any chance to win.
No, it could end up being close, but just because it's the playoffs. But yeah, they should not win this game.
They have to get Saquon Barkley going. If Barkley, and whether that's run game, pass game, whatever way, but they need to get him worked into the game. He opens that
14 off. Touches, not enough for you?
14 against Philly last time?
No, he hit 14 last week, I believe.
But that, and Vikings. I think that some of the touches that would have gone to him went to Daniel Jones scrambling designed runs, and he was doing well against those. I don't think those are going to be there this week, and so those touches need to go to Saquon Barkley because I think that's where think they need to get him going in some way, shape, or form.
All right, so we all picking the Eagles then.
Yep.
Well, sweet. That's the whole slate. That is the whole slate. What game are you guys looking most forward to watching?
Well, as a fan, mine would be the Eagles.
True. Besides moving a different one.
Removing that, probably Dallas, San Francisco.
Ooh.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's the most interesting.
We might all go different here. Brett, what's yours?
I think you'll pick your Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pick the Bengals-Bills game. So we are all going different here.
So it's a great slate is what that means.
It is. There's a lot of exciting matchups. I know the spreads on some of them aren't great. I think like San Francisco's maybe like 8.5 favorites.
Are they? I thought it was like 4 or something.
I know Kansas City, I think, was 9.
They're big. The Eagles are -7.5.
Yeah, and so there's some larger spreads out there, but I still think these games have a potential to be really good. Okay, you're right. 49ers are only 3.5 point favorites. Bills are 5.5 point favorites on the Bengals.
That's backwards. Wow. Those numbers should literally be on different.
I'm going to bet Bengals and 49ers. I think the 49ers spread should be higher than 3.5.
Yeah, you should literally switch those spreads. And I think I'd be like, okay.
Most like true diehard football fans say that this weekend and next weekend are better than the actual Super Bowl Sunday because you get way more football bang for your buck.
Yeah. The teams have more rivalries and stuff.
Yep.
This week,
NFC teams don't really play each other much.
We get Saturday and Sunday again this week. Last time that happens this year.
Yep.
It's all coming to a finish. It's exciting, and we'll see how it comes out.
Right on. All right. Well, let's get out of here then. Quick and dirty, as usual. We will be back next week. We're probably going to throw in an extra episode for you guys either next week or the week after because we are going to do an award show / all-pro voting from the team here. We'll probably do all three of us because that would be fun. And, I don't know, Steve. We'll probably – maybe we should do that the week between Super Bowl and – AFC or the championship weekend, right? Because there's no games to talk about.
Yeah, and that's when the like honors thing is.
Okay, well, I want to do our thing before theirs, so we got to just make sure we do that.
Theirs is that Saturday, I think. So if we do it, it could be perfect.
Okay, so we'll do it that week then. Thank you so much for listening. I am your host Brett Whitefield. These are my fun friends and co-host Stephen O'Rourke and Christopher Wecht, and we are out.
Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Fantasy Points Podcast. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite platform. And come join the roster at fantasypoints.com.